DCT Audio. The art of good listening.
I'm just popping down to the corner shop.
Can you get some milk and take the dog with you?
The corner shop, where ordinary folk tell stories of anecdotes, folklore and legend.
I'm delighted to be joined by a wonderful lady, Sheila McMillan, who's come to the museum today. Sheila, you've got quite a story to tell.
Well, I think so. It's not a story about Darfield directly, but it's about a story about someone who had a very strong connection, and his family did, and I still live in Darfield, and I just want his story to be told.
Now, who are we talking about? It's your grandfather, isn't it?
Yeah, this is a granddad that I didn't know because he died before I was born. And in fact, it was a dad that the children hardly knew, you know, my mum and her siblings, because of what happened to him after the war. So his name's George Bradley. He was born in a little village just 2 miles or so from where we are today in the museum at Broomhill. And he was born into quite a large family and in a very tiny house. And he seems to have been very active in all kinds of ways. He was active in the chapel. He was active in the football teams, the cricket teams. And he was also sometimes a bit active when he shouldn't have been. I was looking when I was doing some research in old newspaper articles, and I found that in October, I think it's 1907, when George would have been 13, he was in trouble with the local police, along with his mates, because they'd been doing the terrible thing of setting fireworks off in the street. And I quite like that, because it makes him into a lad.
Now, obviously, as he got older, I think he went down the pit, and he was quite a productive miner, by all accounts.
Yeah, he was very productive. Many, many years ago, when we were doing some clearing out upstairs, my mum and I were emptying probably a blanket box or something, and there was this frame photograph, and it's a frame photograph I'd never seen before, of this really handsome, and I mean handsome, young man dressed in the uniform of the Yorks and Lancs, got thick black hair, good looking chap. But what really impressed me were his hands. They were clenched on his knees, but they were so strong. They were amazing hands. Anyway, I said to my mum, can I have this photograph? And she couldn't say no, could she, really? So I'm really glad I was a bit forward in asking for something. And we used to have a chap come to our house who'd also served in the Yorks and Lancs, like George obviously did. And he told me that when George worked at the pit, he had a nickname. And because he was such a strong worker, his name was Bull Bradley. Now, at the pit, if they did a really good production week, it was called a Bull Week. So he was obviously a very productive worker.
Now, obviously, and that time, the start of the century, First World War came along. Unfortunately, many men didn't come home from that war. Thankfully, your grandfather did. How was he when he got back?
He apparently joined up not immediately at the start of the war. He joined up, it looks like, October 1915, along with a chum of his who lived just a couple of houses away from them in Broomhill. So they joined up and were posted to France, and then I've never really able to find anything specific, but I did come across one particular newspaper report about how they joined up as chums, it says, at the beginning of the war, and then they'd moved from the Yorks and Lancs into the Royal Engineers. And within the Royal Engineers, they formed a special brigade that, well, it was a really unpleasant set of tasks that they had. It was dealing with the gas and with the flamethrowers. And as they were setting up some, what they call a stunt, one night with a few others, a shell landed in their midst, killing two of them and wounding, amongst others, my grandfather. So he was in the thick of the action. And he came out in 1919 and he came home. So everything seemed to be okay. Now, sadly, when he went home, he found that his sister, who was next to him in the line of children, she wasn't there anymore. And the reason for that was she'd died of the Spanish flu and left two little children who'd now been brought into the house. So there were quite a lot of them in that house. Anyway, being a young man, he used to be on the lookout for a nice young lady. And up in Wunwall, which is not far from here, there was a stretch of the road known as the Bunny Run. And it was the bit, it was the bit of the road where lads and lasses could meet up, unchaperoned, and probably walk up and down and all the rest of it. Anyway, while he was there, he met a young woman, and she worked at the house of Dr. Blackburn, the doctor of Barnsley. She was a domestic servant, and they fell in love. And she would talk in her old age, because she lived to be 97, how in the right time of year, obviously, when they were meeting up, as he approached her, he'd lift his hat and bring out a flower. So obviously they were very, very much in love. So they got married and then they had a family. But then as I looked more into the newspaper reports, I found that it wasn't working. On the open main book, when they're writing up the wages and that, his name's there, but no record of him having worked. And that was in the mid-20s. And then there would been a fundraising concert to help the family in December 1927. So his illness, which seems eventually to have been diagnosed as severe shell shock, was obviously really impacting their lives. By this time, they got a little house down on what we call the Dyke Side, down the Darfield Bridge. So they've got a downstairs room, a teeny weeny kitchen, a bedroom and an attic. And the severe shell shock symptoms must have affected those little girls. They couldn't have got away from it.
It's amazing, isn't it, that it took 9 years for those horrible things that he must have seen in the war to sort of bubble to the surface. But he must have been living with that from the day he left the army.
Yeah, they wouldn't have recognised it at first. And I think the very fact he was back down the pit would be an environment that would often precipitate and bring these memories to the fore. And I can't imagine, someone once said that they used to see him like at the side of the house, but just trembling and incapacitated.
Well, in 1928, he was hospitalised to quite a famous building, I believe, the Star and Garter, which was turned into a convalescent home, I suppose is the best way you could call it. And he spent the rest of his life there. Now, this is based down in Richmond in Surrey. How did that come about?
Well, the local doctor, Dr. Castle, had himself been an ace flyer of types in the early Royal Air Force. And he'd been shot down and he'd been a prisoner of the Germans himself for 16 months. And I think that gave him a particular affinity and a concern for George. I really do. I think he was a very good doctor when you read about what he did generally. And so he got also London origins and no doubt connections. And I think it was through Dr. Castle, because when my mum used to go down there, which was very infrequently, she used to say, we always used to go and see Dr. Castle's mother. And she always used to give my mother this amazing gift of 2 shillings, a florin. And that was big money. Yeah. Because they were living hand to mouth. There weren't the benefits. There was nothing like that. It was a case of applying for parish relief and taking washing in and getting by.
George's family must have struggled while he was in hospital. Because obviously, I suppose in those days, the man was the breadwinner for the family, weren't they?
Yeah, I can't imagine it. I mean, I heard various things from my mum. Odd times she'd say things, like the time when there was a delivery of sort of charity shoes to the school and she was given some and had to wear these shoes. And our people sometimes would be nasty, well, girls would, and say, you ain't got a dad, you. And she had got a dad and she wished she'd got a dad.
1944, George passed away. So he spent a considerable amount of time in the convalescent home. And his funeral was back in Darfield, I believe, just at the height of the Blitz, I suppose.
Well, it's the V1s that were being dropped on London in July, late June and July 44. Richmond itself had been bombed. So that, I think, would have precipitated. On his death certificate, it says heart attack, but obviously it's the shell shock. They call it neurasthenia and severe general debility. In fact, when they used to visit him, they were only allowed to take him out in a bath chair and take him across. I mean, it was a wonderful situation, looking down onto the Thames and Richmond Park. So they could take him out and have some family time. And what I love and makes him so human again is my mum used to say, they always took him his favourite sweets. And actually, they're one of my favourite sweets, licorice allsorts. And whenever I have a licorice allsort, I always think about my granddad. You know, I really do. Yeah, so he came back for burial and that was held up for a day because of the damage in the capital. But he came home and a few years ago, my mum, when she was in her 90s, paid for a new stone It's just minutes from our house. And so it's good I can tend his grave and have a word with him sometimes and tell him he's got a book about him.
Well, such an important story that, as you say, you have written a little book about your experiences and George's own experiences, I suppose. Where can people find this book?
At the moment, it's on sale in Darfield in the museum, which in itself is really worth a visit if you've never been. Lovely cake, coffee and company. It's on sale as well, just up from the museum in the library and also in the card shop a little bit higher up the road. So, and if you have any problem getting it, leave your name and details at the museum or library and I'll see what I can do. And every penny is going to the Poppy Appeal because they were the ones who paid for the travel so they could go down to see the dad.
Sheila, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you today.